Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the NASCA Stop Child Abuse Now Blog Talk Radio Show. NASCA stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And my name is Kim Lakin, and I am your host this evening. My beautiful co-host Penelope is on with us tonight. We're so glad to have her back.
Thank you, Kim. I'm glad to be back.
Thank you.
Well, we don't have a guest tonight, but it looks like we have some people that are filling up the panel. So I know we have one that wants to talk specifically, so it'll be fun. But tonight we are on stand number 3228, and it is 7/19/23. And first we've got to get into all of the logistics, and then we'll go into who wants to talk. So we have a single purpose here at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. One, by educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, also known as CSA. Has any fact showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone? And two, by offering hope and healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone who's interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And again, we're on stand number 3228, and we'd love for you to call in and be a part of our panel. We've got a couple of people on here, and we've got a growing panel coming. So we're excited, but we could always have more voices. It's always fun to have more people on. So that guest call-in number is 646-595-2118. And my co-host, Penelope, will meet you on the back line and ask you if you have any questions, or we may just even bring you on tonight. We'll just see how it all goes if you have a question. But if you want to access any of our past shows or access this one in the future, you just go over to NASCA.org, that's NAASCA, and search for the scan number that I just said, like 3228 is tonight, and you can bring up whatever number. We've got 3,228 episodes on there, so there's lots to choose from. But tonight we have several people on. So Bob Eden is joining us again this evening, and we always enjoy having Bob on with us. And then we also have Wolf on again with us. So we always enjoy having Philip on with us as well. So should we just bring Bob on and let him start telling us what he's
going to
talk about? Hello, Bob.
Yeah.
Good evening. Good day.
Hey. Good day. Yeah, it's just after 10 a.m. here. Another beautiful day in paradise. Yeah, and what I would like to talk about today is my 10-step program the steps I went through to get from trauma and despair to contentment. But I would also like it to be interactive. And so what I'd like to do is like go through step one, and then we'll have a little chat about it. And then step two, and have a little chat about it. But also, I would like to share a funny little story about how nature is nurture. And would you like to hear that at the beginning or at the end?
Sure.
Well,
Let's start it. Let's start with it. Yeah, let's start.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
Yeah. For me, science is a sickness and nature is a cure. Nature is nurture. And this is a classic example from my own life. You know, I don't own a pair of shoes, and I live as close to nature as I can. But about 10 days ago, I got a bite from nature. I got a tick bite on the inner thigh of my left leg. Yeah, and, and I didn't notice it. I just thought it was a skin tag, you know. I pulled it out, and then my leg went really crimson purple, you know, from sort of groin to knee. Wow, you know, this is pretty serious. But it wasn't itching or anything. So I just let it go. And then after about 4 or 5 days, it was so horrific, I took myself to the hospital. And this was my Sunday at about 7 a.m. And a great little hospital, you know, went straight in, saw the triage nurse. She looked at the problem because fluids were building up in various parts of my body. And I don't know, you know, anyway. So I saw the doctor, a GP, and then he got his boss in to have a look as well. And so, to cut a long story short, I left there with a handful of prescriptions for 2 lots of antibiotics and some antifungal cream. Because I've also been fighting or trying to heal what we call here in Australia jock itch, you know, which is a fungal infection. Anyway, so I'm driving home thinking about this, because I don't like Big Pharma at all. And I just thought, I asked myself this question, Bob, and it goes back to, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. So I asked myself this question, now what have I changed in my diet recently that may have caused this? And so it was probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I got into eating yogurt. And I thought, you know, this is pretty healthy, you know. And also, instead of eating bags of crisps or chips or whatever you want to call them, so I was eating a pot of yogurt every day, and also a bag of grapes. And I thought, well, the timing's just about right. You know, so I did some research on this yogurt, and it's got about 15 grams per 100 grams of sugars in it. So I looked up, you know, what feeds these sort of infections, and it's sugars and carbohydrates. So I went to the chemist and, you know, spent me $30 on these prescriptions, but then the only one I've used actually is the cream. But so I ditched the yogurt, I ditched the grapes, and I went back to my strict carnivore diet. And in 3 days, well, in a day, all the fluid that had built up had disappeared, and the color of the rash from the bite had really, really faded. And now I'm 5 days down the track. And it's just amazing. It just reinforced. I had forgotten my own mantra, you know, that nature is nurture. I dropped back into believing Big Pharma's here. to help me. So that was just a classic example of, so does anybody want a load of antibiotics? Because I got some despair.
Well, you know, that is, I love that. Thank you for sharing that story. I know a few years ago, it was a mosquito bite. We don't have as many ticks. We have ticks out here, but I think they're out in the mountains more. And I'm more in the city. I'm kind of in the foothills, actually. But I got a mosquito bite, and it kept, like, getting worse and worse, like, welling up and getting red. And then all of a sudden, it started to go down. But then my legs hurt like crazy, like you couldn't even hardly touch it. And I went to the emergency room, too, because I'd gone to my grandson's soccer game or something, and I could barely walk. And so I went in, and they did, you know, some blood tests and stuff, and they were like, nope, we don't see anything wrong. Well, it kept hurting really, really bad over, and that was like on a Saturday. I went to the emergency room, and so by Monday, I was like, I'm going to go see my doctor. And it had already started a real bad infection like that. They gave me antibiotics because I probably do more of that than I do the nature, which I shouldn't do. So I know. I'd like to work on that, Bob. But but I was getting ready to go do a speaking presentation for my National Association of Adult Survivors. Not this one, I'm sorry, but Darkness to Light. But for Darkness to Light, I was speaking at their national conference. That's what I'm trying to say. And I had to take crutches with me to Chicago. Wobble around the airport. I finally did get help, though, because I didn't wobble too far. But yeah, though, I mean, it's amazing to me that, like, you, what happened to you, that can happen just from a little tick or from a little mosquito. And I think that it just goes to show us also that I think that the things that are flying around these days are a lot more poisonous, I guess you could say, than they used to be, I think, you know, like the Zika virus and all that you can get with. You know, do you guys have that over there?
Well,
mosquitoes?
Here in Australia, our mozzies ride around on trail bikes. They're huge, you know.
You're but, from Triple Lard but, there. I say that about the South.
But another example of how nature is nurturing my life is in 2005, I spent a lot of time working on tall ships, you know, so I'm barefoot on the boat and was putting my shoes back on when I came ashore. But and up until that time, I used to catch whatever bug was going around, whether it was mad cow disease or, you know, colds and flus or what, you know, I just used to, it's my magnetic personality. I used to attract all these.
It attracts you.
Yeah. But in 2005, I decided to go totally barefoot. So I do not own a pair of shoes, and I've gone barefoot since that time. And you know what? Since that time, I have not even had a sniffle. I haven't, just by connecting back to Earth and the Earth energy. And I know I'm still putting toxins in my body, but while I was wearing shoes, and they've all got sort of rubber or insulating soles, the only way those toxins would come out, show themselves, is in, you know, illness. But since I've gone barefoot, yeah, all these toxins drain out as I walk this land barefoot. But anyway, shall we get into
wow,
my 10 steps?
Well, let's see if Penelope. Do we see if Penelope has anything to say about that real quick?
Yeah.
She's on the
thank you. Well, thanks for sharing, you know, your story, Bob, and some of your comments too, Kim, because it prompted me to, you know, really remember in terms of just my own healing that I don't have a specific story, but that sometimes if life gets unpredictable and I'm or faced with something that's very, very stressful or even a trauma, that I tend to freeze, which is an old pattern from childhood, living in, you know, unpredictable circumstances or situations, and I don't pay attention, you know. And so I think that, you know, one of the things that I talk about, one of the things I teach in my practices is mindfulness and meditation, which is really an opportunity just to stop and really focus in on what's going on right now. And so I think, Bob, you know, when you said you noticed, or Kim, you said you know, I mean, we have to remember, to me it's daily, I have to remember to stop and focus. No matter how many, you know, currents are flowing, you know, sometimes everything's smooth and smooth sailing, but sometimes things are very, there's a strong current. And so I have to remember not to be managed by those and to just pay attention. So it's not really a specific antidote, but just more of a general comment, because I think, you know, it's a lot about what we're talking about is noticing. And going back to some of the things that have served us before.
Yeah, I agree. For me, as master and commander of this life that I do create and I take full responsibility for, every event that happens in my life holds a lesson for me. And all I've got to do is listen to me. And denial is not a big river in Africa.
Oh, that's cute, Bob.
Yeah.
Those are both cute. I should write them down so I remember them. No, thanks for sharing that, Penelope. But I think the other point also that I wanted to make, and then just to your point too, Penelope, is that I do eat sugar. I'm a sugar person. So I like sugar too. So that was a kind of an aha moment, Bob, when you were talking about, you know, all of the toxins and stuff that I put in my body and that it feeds on the sugars. And I've heard that about cancer, too, that feeds on kind of the glucose in your body, the sugars and stuff. So,
yeah. What I've discovered about cancer, because both of my parents were taken by cancer, is that for me, it all comes down to a dis-ease of the soul. But there are so many natural remedies to cancer. The standard American diet, the SAD diet, makes the body acidic, which is an environment that cancers live in. And so going back to a natural diet, and making the body alkaline, no cancer can thrive in an alkaline environment. Just wondering, has Philip got anything to say?
Yeah, let's ask Philip. Let's bring him on. He hasn't been on with us yet. So we're bringing you on, Philip.
Hello, guys. Was it a diet that you were talking about?
Oh, yeah, Philip. The carnivore diet, and I don't give advice, but I love this guy, Dr. Ken Berry. And, he's just an amazing, wholesome, loving, warm-centered MD. And he's got loads of info on the carnivore diet.
I've been watching my sugar lately. and I've been drinking a lot of water and milk.
Good. Yeah, and the water especially. That's what I'm always pushing on my grandkids. Drink water, drink water.
Yeah. What I've noticed about water is, you know, go back a couple of hundred years and the rain would fall on the mountains and run downstream and pick up lovely minerals and energy from the earth. And, you know, spring water, it was beautiful, it was uncontaminated. But now even our rain contains plastic microparticles and fluoride and all sorts of contaminants. So I would push to find a way to drink what they call living water. But enough of that. If you would like, I would like to go to step one of my 10-step program, if you like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, let's go ahead and start on.
Okay, well, step number one. Yeah, thanks, Phil. Number one was healing the wounds of my childhood. Now, I had a very violent childhood, but as a child, I didn't know. I just thought this was normal, you know, and every other child went through the same sort of experience. And unfortunately, that thought was valid, because the more people I connect with, I reckon in Western society, very few children were left unscathed by their childhood. But for me, healing the wounds of my childhood was the most powerful work I've ever done. Now, I knew I couldn't change my past, but I had a feeling that I could go back and heal it. And synchronistically, I came across the work of John Bradshaw in the early 90s on healing the shame that binds you and the inner child stuff. And so my partner and I at the time, we bought all these VHS tapes and we used to play them two or three times a week for our friends because we were running a sort of a bit of a spiritual retreat, which is not bad for a fair turner, eh? After a while, you know, John's presentations, I was word perfect on them. You know, I really, really sort of soaked them up. But the core of it was just going back to my childhood, and just remembering all the times that I was terrified, all the times that I was hurt. And around about 92, I got to this space where, God, I hate you, Mum. You're always beating me. Why are you doing that? But you've got to love your Mum. You've only got one Mum. And it was that dichotomy that was tearing my soul apart. So how did I move through this? Well, I sat down and wrote a letter to Mum. Dear Mum, your loving son, Bobby, I'm just writing this letter to tell you how I felt as a child growing up in our family. This is not about blame. I'm just telling you my story. So I started. I got the notepad out and I started writing. I hated it when you dangled me by the wrist and hit me with the frying pan. I hated it when you threw the rolling pin at me. I was still gonna, you know, and what I thought was going to be one or two pages ended up like being really about an inch thick of all the wounds that I could recall. And once I'd written it all down, that was quite releasing. But I signed off, Mum, please tell me your story, your loving son, Bobby. And then, and this is one of the hardest things I ever did, I went down to the post office and I posted it to her. And, you know, I'm in Australia, she's in England. So eventually I got a letter back from Mum saying, oh, Bobby, you must think I'm the best mother in the whole world. But I was only doing my very best. And I wrote back, Mum, this is not about blame. Tell me your story. So eventually she wrote back and told me about her childhood. She was born in 1924 in Germany between the wars. Her dad was an alcoholic. Her mum was a control freak. Her cousins were in the SS, so they were shot. And she basically, she had a shit childhood too. And that was so liberating because there was I sitting in this state of anger and hatred. But by her sharing her story and me understanding, I came to the realization that, yeah, mum was doing her very, very best. But all that she could do was dump on me what got dumped on her. So by exchanging, sending her my letter, I'd actually broken the multi-generational cycle of abuse. And so after I got a letter, a couple of days later, I phoned her in the UK and she was back in hospital with another bout of cancer. And that's the first time we spoke as mother and son, and we were both bawling our eyes out, and you know, but they were joyous tears. And then 3 days later, she died. And I thought, wow, what a beautiful closure. And then it was like somebody had taken an elephant off my shoulders. Oh, wow. But hey, hang on. What's this niggle in my shoulder here? What's this? Still got a little niggle here. What's that? Right, Dad, you bastard. So I got the notepad out and wrote a similar letter to Dad because he was never there. He was just working all the time. He was living his programming. He was doing what dads were supposed to do then, which is bring home the bacon. But he died, and I didn't know where, and I had a sort of an idea when, but I wrote the letter anyway and just put it in an envelope to Dad in heaven and burned it. And that, in that way, I healed the wounds of my childhood. And my healing was not complete until I was able to forgive my two primary abusers. So that's, and, you know, I cannot recommend this work enough because for me it's fundamental. But, yeah, let's have a chat about that one, step one.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you for sharing that. And just your vulnerability, I really appreciate it anyway, and I know the rest of us do, the rest of the listeners, because there's so many people that, there's so many men that need to hear from other men, specifically. I mean, I think that that's so empowering to hear you say that you beat those demons. Because like you said, there are so many people out there. I mean, like my statistics, I tell everybody, you know, 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 boys. So that's, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that are suffering, and your story helps a lot. So thank you. Thank you for being one of those voices. So we go to Penelope and see what Penelope has to say.
Thank you, Kim. And, you know, thank you, Bob, for, you know, your that step and what you disclosed. And, yeah, I mean, I would say that I, too, believe, and I did also go through the exercise of writing a letter to each one of my parents, my primary abusers, and the letters were started when they were still alive, and they were prompted by my psychologist, who's a trauma-informed psychologist, to actually name the abuse and to write it down, because you have to, A, get it out and speak of it and to bring it out from within. And the second part of the benefit of writing it out, putting it on paper, becomes real in terms of just becomes, when I say it's real, it becomes a tangible piece of something that can be tangibly passed on to someone else, so it's tangible. It was also to give someone a letter. So in this letter, it was formatted where I wrote, it was like 2 suitcases from things from my childhood, things that were great, things that were not. and I was going to keep the great stuff in the, and put all the great stuff in one suitcase and keep it with me, and I was going to put all the other bad stuff in another suitcase and give it back to them. So in terms of reading the letter and signing the letter and giving them the letter, it was, you know, a way to, you know, release and give back what I was carrying. The children carry the blame, I think, the blame of the abuse. We carry the axe. And it was a way to give it back to the person that really should own it. And so for me, I did that. And I did that, I too felt the relief that you did, because I didn't realize the weight of the burden I've been carrying, of carrying really the blame and responsibility for what had happened to me as a very young child and for decades. I mean, went on for a very long time. And until I couldn't have known the weight of that burden had I not written it out and given it back and released it. So I totally can resonate with what you said. For me, that step was profoundly freeing and a huge leap in my own recovery. After I did that, there was no going back. And so thank you for sharing, and I had a similar experience.
Well, it's a little caveat in my letter to Mum. About 3 years down the track, I contacted my mum, who died, through a spiritual medium, and this lady was telling me stuff that only Mum and I would know. So I knew this medium was Fair Dinkum, and the message I got from Mum was, Bobby, thank you so much for sending that letter, because I am now doing the same work with my parents in the beyond. And that blew me away.
Wow.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I'm, can you guys hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
That dichotomy is tearing my soul apart too. Like, sometimes my mom isn't the nicest person in the world, and everybody says that she's like a perfect little angel.
People say she's what? We didn't hear that last word.
And everybody just says she's the perfect angel.
She treats you and abuses you, but everybody thinks that she's an angel to the outside world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, I think that's really hard, because they put on this really good mask. I mean, that's probably how she's learned to hide. And I think, I mean, you don't talk a whole lot about them specifically, but from some of the things you've told me about Mom, it reminds me a lot of my husband. And I think that they're, you know, we can say that we need to forgive or whatever, you know, and we do, I think eventually everybody needs to get that off their chest. But I'm not going to tell people when they have to, because I think that's going to be different for everybody. And everybody needs to process it differently, too. I know that I never really got that closure with my mom, but I'm working on it more now than I ever did when she first died, or even when she was alive. So I think it all comes. I mean, it's hard. It is hard when you, and the reason why I say your mom reminds me of Andy is because the outside world doesn't see what happens on the inside. And they're so good at hiding it. I mean, it's probably come from her parents. You know, her parents were probably good at hiding and masking the fact that they weren't healthy. I mean, I don't know. You probably know your grandparents more than I do, but I know that that's my grandparents' story, for sure, too. So It's hard. You can't say you have to forget.
Sorry.
But go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to. I did want to respond to Philip as well. I'm sorry. I did not mean to interject from you. But Philip, I just wanted to say that I can totally relate to what you're saying exactly. Like, I'm nodding my head as you're saying that because for two reasons. One, I mean, in terms of my parents, I mean, they were, you know, pillars of society. And, you know, they, no one would believe, right, the truth of, you know, what had actually happened. And so I think as a child and even, you know, our inner child, even as we're adults, I mean, it's hard enough for us to admit to ourselves the truth about the child abuse, the sexual child abuse, at least for me. And that was excruciating. So, you know, for me to actually do the work and actually admit the truth to myself was hard. But then, you know, you have society at large that has this opinion that your truth, your hard-fought, you know, truth, you know, is going to not be credible. And that is really, really difficult because we know it's true. And by the way, as Kim said, 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 boys by the age of 18 are going to be sexually abused. Well, who do they think is doing all this? I mean, it happens. And it happens across, you know, all different, you know, socioeconomic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds. No one is immune. You know, no culture, no region. I mean, unfortunately, abuse is an equal opportunity event. And so I think, you know, I wish and I hope with the work that we're all doing that people understand that this is not abuse and sexual abuse isn't, you know, happening in those other neighborhoods to those other people. It happens everywhere. And, you know, your mother, I think you're referencing, even though no one would ever believe it, you know, we have to get over that because that is part of the problem. So I just wanted to say I totally get it. Yeah.
I would like to respond to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you have to say?
Yeah, for me, several things were prompted by, you know, the last few minutes, is that the child that's being abused does not stop loving its abusers, it stops loving itself. And for me, the most prolific form of abuse is abandonment. And I'll explain that. And it can be abandonment like a mum puts a baby up for adoption, or parents are not there for you. You know, I grew up in the era where it was spare the rod, spoil the child. I think mum was trying to beat me into wellness. or children should be seen and not heard. So there is that abandonment. And how I can explain it is when a child is born, there is a soul connection of trust between the mother and the child. And so through abandonment, that trust is broken. And that, for me, is one of the biggest wounds. And I cannot imagine, from what I see in Western society, where abandonment has not happened for any child in Western society. But looking at the time, I'd like to go on to the next step two, if that's okay with you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and let's have some fun. Anybody want a cup of coffee? Right. Oh, dear. Right, step two was deprogram myself from codependent behavior. And for me, political correctness is the epitome of codependent behavior and the absolute antithesis of free speech. For me, we are all sovereign, unique, and equal. But there was one little phrase when I was doing that work of deprogramming myself from codependent behavior, was unsolicited advice is abuse. And for me, going back to, you know, we're all sovereign, unique and equal, everybody's on their own hero's journey. But in my journey, when I was struggling the most, I'm surrounded by all these rescuers, you know, they seem to be drawn in. I know what you need to do, mate, you know, and I said, whoa, brother, you know, hold up there. I'm here to live my life my way, not your way. If you want to be a true friend, be around when I put my hand up and ask for help. So deprogramming myself from codependent behavior was it's taken a long time because it's so insidious in our culture. But on the other side of it, you know, now, because I just follow the one law, which is do no harm, and I've only got one right, and that's the right of self-determination, I just speak my truth in the moment. So all I am doing is sharing data. How anybody responds to that is their responsibility. So that was a really, really liberating exercise for me. Anybody got any comments?
Yeah, that's so good. I was sitting there going,
Yeah.
I try and mute myself so that I don't distract you too much. But absolutely. I think that I'm working on that. It's taken me a long time. I've been one of those slow learners. But I've noticed, too, that I have a hard time getting my feelings out. So I think the whole writing it down, I do sometimes, but I don't. But I'm doing, I don't know if you were on when we had the lady that does the Gestalt equine therapy lessons. That is really good. That's what I'm starting to do. So I have my second session tomorrow. But that they really are working more with just trying to get all of that out and then recognize that you have a voice, because that's what a lot of us have been silent, you know, we've all been silent throughout our life. So we do have a voice. Awesome. And I still struggle with that. How about you guys? What do you think?
Well, Bob, I agree. I think that in terms of what you said about also a child and their connection to self-love and self-respect, and I think that self-blame and lack of self-love must be related or cousins in some way. In my experience, they just went hand in hand. I think if my self-blame was self-hatred, you know, I hated myself and I blamed myself for the things that happened. These things started happening the minute I was born. And now logically we know as adults, of course, like an infant, a toddler is not responsible for the behavior, conduct, actions of anyone else. But if you blame yourself, if you hate yourself, it's really hard to love yourself. So I do think, you know, for me, and I think in terms of healing, it's something that I had to learn what that was, self-love was, and I had to learn how to nurture and love myself too. And it sounded, I felt almost like it felt sounded indulgent at first, until I realized how important it was, because I can't really be the best friend, mother, brother, I mean sister, daughter, you know, wife, to my family if I'm, you know, if I haven't made peace with myself and if I don't love myself. So thank you for saying, I think I read that resonated with me.
Yeah.
Okay. Wait, what was that last part?
You resonate.
What if you haven't loved yourself?
Well, I can't be a good employee, a good friend, a good sister, a good mother, a good wife, you know, a good daughter. If I can't be the best version of all those things if I don't love myself, you know, because that's self-respect. That's, you know, how I treat myself. So that's what I meant, is that I was ever better to be, I was able to be more present, you know, more authentic, more empathetic, more attuned, but less of a rescuer. The more I became aware of the fact that I needed to love myself. Sometimes rescuing someone else and being someone else's rescuer is not a self-loving. That takes a toll. So even something, you know, like that, you know, I had to realize I did come back to, I had to love myself enough to know to draw it, to have boundaries. To me, that was part of the self-love, is boundaries are loving. And I had, so those were connected for me as well. Does that make sense, Philip?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, connecting those boundaries and speaking up for yourself. I mean, I think that's not easy for anyone.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, something else.
Bearing that in mind, that was step two. I'd like to skip to step six, and then we go back for three, four, and five after that. And step six was reclaim my belief in me. Now, when did I first lose my belief in myself? And again, this is the benefit of doing the inner child work and going back there. And my earliest recollection was, I was about 4.5 years old. It was a Sunday morning. I bounced out of bed, brushed my hair and combed my teeth and put on my red t-shirt, bounced down and breakfast, sat down at the table, and Mum said, "Bobby, go up and put your blue t-shirt on. You know you love your blue t-shirt." And I thought, well, no, I don't. I love my red t-shirt. But mum must be right, because she's mum, and she's very violent, and she's very angry, and she's about 80 foot tall. So I went up, and I put my blue t-shirt on. And that is the first recollection I have in no longer believing in me, and believing that other people, authority figures, knew what was best for me. And that became my modus operandi for about, probably 50 years, you know. I believed the doctors when they said, "You've got chronic depression, you need to take these drugs." I believed my teachers, you know. It was a nightmare, but it was about 2008, and I was living on my boat in Pioneer Bay. It's about 7:30 at night, which is dark up here in the tropics. And I was sitting down below with my dog Barnaby on Facebook, and I was actually on my dog's Facebook page because I always got a giggle. And all of a sudden the lights went dim. So I peered over at the voltmeter, 12.5 volts, that's okay. And I couldn't breathe. You know, it's like, there's no pain. You know, I haven't got a pain in the chest or a pain in the right arm, or, you know. And just off to the left of my vision, like you see in the movies, there was this black, wispy, silky presence just hovering, just on the limit of my vision. And I thought, oh, no. Hello, old friend. I thought, you know, I thought it was all over Red Rover. The Grim Reaper had come to get me, you know, the Angel of Death. So I just typed into Barnaby's Facebook page, "Hey guys, if you don't hear anything from me in the next 20 minutes, can you please call Volunteer Marine Rescue to come out and get Barnaby? Because I thought I was going to die, you know, with this presence next to me. And I'm still not breathing. And I don't know about you folks, if you've experienced any sort of near-death experiences, time becomes irrelevant. So I'm sitting there, instead of panicking, I could have typed in, hey, send the ambulance guys out, you know, I think I'm having a heart attack or whatever. But I just sat centered and let my body do what it needed to do. So I'm sitting on my boat down below in the tropics. I'm naked, probably too much information, but you live on a boat in the tropics. And so I walked up onto the deck and I looked up the sky and there were two full moons. And then my boat's in a bay surrounded by mangrove trees where crocodiles live. And it's after dark when crocodiles and sharks feed. Bugger the sharks. So I just leapt into the bay and I still haven't taken a breath. And I floated up and spread out like a great big starfish. And all of a sudden, my body just went... And it didn't cough then. But I started breathing again. And that was the night that I bet my life on trusting my inner tuition, my intuition, my gut instinct. And that was my rite of passage. Hello, folks.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, I didn't know if you were done yet. Right. Thank you for that. Just so you know, also, I just want to just let you know that in the past, I know that it, you know, it just comes out because you're telling your story, and we love your, you know, and I appreciate you telling the story. Just maybe keep the naked part out. Sometimes that's triggering to people. You just never know. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, well, God created me naked. I was born naked, and I'll die naked.
Well, he did. He sure did. I know, but, you know, we just try and be respectful. That's all of everybody, because there are a lot of triggers, and we don't know who that is.
Well,
but,
can I respond to the trigger?
Yeah.
I'd love to respond to that word, triggers, because that goes back to codependent behavior.
Yeah.
For me, once upon a time, I too had triggers until I realized that those triggers were just showing me the areas where I needed to do more work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, absolutely.
And so
I agree with you. I think I still have a lot of triggers that I need to work on.
And so now I simply share my story, share my truth in the moment. And how people respond to that, well, that's their responsibility. And I love this line from Shakespeare. It's, the greatest love I can give to anyone is to simply share my own truth.
Yeah.
You know, Bob, it's Penelope, and I totally hear what you're saying. I completely hear what you're saying. And triggers are, you know, obviously an issue that, you know, we've dealt with in the past or we deal with in the present. And what I'll say is, triggers can be worked on if you can understand why you're being triggered. But for someone like me who had nocturnal visits from my perpetrator when I was sexually abused, so I was asleep, I have bodily triggers, but I don't know where they come from. And I just struggle with how to control them.
So when you're not awake and something happens to you, you know, your mind may not know, but your body doesn't forget. So I always like to challenge a little bit on triggers because I don't think they're equal opportunities, just my perspective.
Well, that's a beautiful statement because you just nailed it there. Because for me, where I am now, the guiding beacon in my life is my body. Whatever happens to my body remembers, and my body is always sending me messages. And so the best thing that I do now is just listen to my body and obey, because my body always knows what it needs to do to heal.
Yeah, and I think that's a great, yeah, that was deep. That was good. No, and I think that it would be very, very helpful in the world, wherever people are, that if we could get to that point. I mean, I think that a lot of times, and especially a lot of people that are probably in NASCA themselves and a part of the group, are working on that. I mean, we're all working on trying to figure out what brings us peace. And so I think that even hearing you and your story and how you talk about things is very encouraging to some people. But and it's encouraging to me too, because I know that that's where I'm at. But it took me 48, you know, 50 years to get there. So that's, unfortunately, that's where I was at. But I definitely appreciate, you know, for sure that you share that stuff with us, because I think that's important. I also think it was important that we kind of have that conversation on triggers, because we don't talk about that a whole lot. We don't talk about triggers. And we've gotten both perspectives of, you know, a completely full-healed human being that we're talking to, which is great to aspire for. And, you know, then the in-between, and then also probably people that listen to it that just really aren't there and aren't ready to be able to process it. And so I think we're having a great conversation. I like it when we start talking about because I think it is. I think it's good. We need to. Go ahead.
Well, Kim, it's Penelope. I mean, I totally agree. I just think, though, that, you know, we're all, as Bill Murray says, and I think he says this very, very well, you know, people are in different phases of their recovery in terms of, I don't think you're ever done. But, you know, some people are different. You know, we should not give ourselves a timer on addressing these things. We're all in different places, and everybody has a slightly different experience. And, you know, so one of the things that I found the most helpful in my healing was really able to help me move forward was to realize that, you know, I had to be patient with myself and stop giving myself deadlines or expectations. You know, there are no expectations other than to keep in the process of recovery. And so I think that, you know, I learned so much from people like Bob that have, you know, been very successful in their healing journey and have all this to share. You know, but I think sometimes it's easy to go down the road, well, gosh, you know, don't compare, right? It's because it's, I think that's a self, deprecating, it can be very self-deprecating and harmful. So I do, you know, I always tell myself, I haven't walked anybody else's shoes, and, I should, you know, there shouldn't be comparison, and there is no timer, you know, there is no timer. I just wanted to.
Yes, precisely, darling. You've nailed it. It's how can we? It just goes back to the Sioux principle for me. We're all sovereign, unique, and equal, and everybody's on their own hero's journey. So, this idea of comparison—that's just ego. And the way I view my own healing journey, it is a journey. It's not a destination. You know, I can't envisage a state of being where I am totally healed. Because if I reach that stage, growth stops. Yeah. And what we've just done is cover step 7, listen to and obey my body. And I would like to drop back to step 4 because this was really pivotal for me, if that's okay with you guys. And step 4 was question everything to establish my own truth. Again, this is comes back to about 2005. I became a ship's captain, and I realized that when I took a boat out, bugger Bob, the buck stops with you. You're responsible for the lives of all these people on the boat, and even the vibe. And it was a time of a really powerful transition, because I realized that everything, how can I put it? As a baby, I was born, and I like the computer analogy. I had my basic operating system, which is I was a magical spiritual entity in this physical body, and the world was magical, and I'd totter around, enjoying the magic. But then the programming started, and about 2008, I just started questioning everything that I'd been programmed with since that time when I was, a little tottering child. And I began to realize that just about everything I was told or taught by my parents, by my education or indoctrination system, by my social interactions, by mainstream media, they're all lies. All lies. And I was so damn angry that it had taken me 50-odd years to realize that I'd been living in this pile of programs, like Robert the Robot. And so at that time, I set my life purpose, because I'm creator of my life, I set my life purpose to be to simply find my own truth. And how do I know what is my truth? Whatever resonates with my heart. And so since that time, I've just been questioning everything that was in the programming suitcase. Thanks for that. Yeah, and just establishing my own truth. And it is that simple. So now, I'm quite happy. I just share my story. I share my truth. For me, all opinions are worthless, even this one. Because for me, all opinions are like hearsay evidence in court. They're invalid. The most valuable thing that I can share is my own personal life experience. That is my witnessed testimony. And it is inviolate. And everybody else has their own story, their own witnessed testimony, their life journey. And for me, there is no argument, because we're all sovereign, unique, and equal. there's no argument, there's only difference. Your truth will be different than mine. Blah, blah, blah. And I expect that, because it is that difference that makes us all uniquely unique. So instead of being, my truth is more true than your truth, beating each other. And that's the trouble. Our whole society is set up for us to all be in competition with each other. And for me, that's a spiritual failing. We're not here to be in competition with each other. We're here to cooperate with each other. We are here to lift each other. All else is This phrase came to me the other day, and I still can't believe it. You know, it's for me, there is an intentional program running in the background that is hell-bent on normalizing corruption. Oh, wow. That was deep. Anybody got a good joke?
I have a joke.
Get out of the deep. Okay, go ahead.
Did you hear about the man who had the hot air balloon business?
No.
Would you like to hear how his work was? Would you like to hear about his work?
Yeah. What about his work?
He had its ups and downs.
Cute.
That's awesome.
I don't think I've ever heard that. Yeah. Does anyone have anything to say about either what Bob was saying or what Philip said? Any comments?
Well, I think that laughter is definitely good medicine, so thank you for that, Philip. That's my comment.
Oh, no problem. I told that joke to a lot of people this week.
Have you? You try and learn a new one every week so that you got something to change it up to?
No, but that's a good idea.
Yeah. Go get a book or something. When my kids were little, I used to put notes in their lunches, you know, and I found these like little cards that had like jokes on them or just funny sayings and stuff. They really liked. It's fun. So, yeah, I know they've got all kinds of books that have jokes in them. You could probably find some really good ones in there, too. Or probably online. I don't know why I say books, because I'm old-fashioned, I guess, but probably just book online.
What I would like to share is, this is probably the most profound conversation I've had in a very, very long time. And one of the most important steps that I took, and this is step 5, and you can find all this stuff in my books anyway or on my YouTube channel. Step 5 was take full responsibility for this life that I do create. And so in 2005, when I became a ship's captain, I took that ideology and applied it to my whole life. Yes, I am master and commander of this life that I do create, and I take full responsibility for it. And it was at that time that I set my my life purpose to be simply justify my own truth, which ties in with what we're talking, but also as a spiritual being have a physical experience. I ask myself this question: okay, how do I want to experience this life? So I set my own conscious life intention, which is I am here to have a gentle, joyful, loving, healthy, and abundant life. And ever since I put that conscious life intention in place, that is precisely how my life is unfolding. The I am here is my command to the universe to deliver what follows. But it's also my address to the universe, so it knows where to deliver what I've commanded. And so, here I am, living in paradise in my own Garden of Eden, and the universe is doing all the hard work. And this all comes from step 7, listen to and obey my body, which we've already talked about. Step 8, follow my heart. And for me, my heart is my only compass, and my inner tuition is my only guide, which covers step 9, trust my inner tuition. And this is my favorite step, step 10, never take myself too seriously. Wow, what a
you gotta laugh at yourself, huh?
Yeah.
That's a good one, never take yourself seriously.
Yeah,
I know that Bill likes to be on, likes to talk about this too, because he's done a lot of work in the 12-step program, so he's probably listening and shaking his head. What were you going to say, Penelope? Were you going to say something?
No, I wasn't. I was actually thinking something, so I must have been thinking so hard you heard me. But, you know, I try not to take life or myself too seriously. But, you know, having had 3 boys all year apart, so now in college, it's like I had to be the serious one because of the antics, right? So I found myself always being serious. So I'm trying to lighten up a bit. So I agree. It's good not to take oneself too seriously.
Yeah, well, the only one that takes you seriously is you, eh?
Yeah, because our kids sure don't, do they, Penelope?
No, they don't.
A lot of times our kids don't do that. They don't like to do that. But, no, I agree with you. I think that that is probably my experience as well, as I was the one that was always with them, so I had to have some discipline. I also didn't want, because I felt like my mom shared too much, and so I was probably more careful than maybe I could have maybe opened up more to them as they got older, but I just didn't want to burden them with anything, and so I wanted them to be all, you know, happy and healthy and not know about, you know as little about burdens as possible, and not that that's always good for children either. And I think that there are times that shows too, because I
well, yeah. All
didn't
I can
always
say is,
stand my ground. Go ahead.
All I can say is every step I've ever taken, however painful, has brought me here to contentment.
When do you think you got to that point, Bob? When was that? How old were you when you got to that point?
But when I reclaimed my belief in me, so I had my first panic attack in 84, so I'd be 32 then. And I've got an amazing intellect. My IQ is 150. Einstein's 160, go figure. But I wasted over 20 years in the trap of the intellect, trying to think my way out of depression. And it was only when I had to silence my mind that I could actually start healing, because listening to my mind and listening to my body, you know, that was the healing path for me. And it might be different for other people. But how long have I free? How long have I been free? Probably 2005, when I became a ship's captain and took total responsibility for this life I do create, and realizing that every event that happens in my life, whether good or bad, holds a lesson for me. So it's 2005. What's that? 18 years now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
I like it.
That's really good. Yeah, that's really good. And you know, I was thinking about that when you're talking about, feeling with your heart and not your head, and that's exactly what that the equine therapy is, because the horses, you know, don't let you, they won't interact with you if you are thinking with your head. So the horse that chose, I guess she said that she chose me when she introduced me to work with me, wouldn't even follow me around. She's like, you know, I'll walk around the whole pen and say positive affirmations, and I have a hard time with that. I still do. I'm working on that. That's why I'm there. But she wouldn't, the horse wouldn't follow me around because it wasn't sincere. It wasn't from my heart. I wasn't saying the affirmations that I believed for me, because I'm still struggling with that. But when I stood still and then just kind of started thinking and feeling with my heart more, instead of trying to even say it out loud, then the horse came up beside me and kind of nudged me. And then my therapist said something, and it must have made me think with my head again, and then she walked away. So it's interesting. I love that they can kind of pick that up for you and help guide you in that way too, just like nature, just like what you're talking about. You know,
yeah, well, it's
everything's
funny.
There for us. Yeah,
it's funny. My dog just came up to me and kissed my wrist. And what I value about Skipper and any dog I've had, if my life ever gets complicated, it's because my mind has jumped back in the driving seat. And what I love about having a dog in my life is they are always, always totally in the moment.
Yeah, just like horses. I think that's why, you know, animals are such good things to have around with, especially when you are dealing with PTSD and things like that, because they really do help absorb some of that and make you just start to let go.
So why do we call them dumb?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. They're pretty smart, really. Yeah.
They've got it nailed.
And especially, well, you know, cats are a little bit more confident about what they're doing. Dogs, they want you to, they're a lot like us. They want approval. You know, they want to just be loved and do whatever makes them happy. So I think that's kind of funny to see that difference. But what do you have to say about that, Penelope or Philip? Is there anything to say?
Well, sometimes my dog don't take a... Sometimes, like, one of my dogs is kind of like for the first time in a while, the first time that anybody's ever came up to me and wanted to cuddle. So that was kind of nice.
And they know. I mean, they sense it. It's just like they know when you're afraid of them. You know, they sense all of that. Yeah, it's so sweet.
I have two cats, and I have one of them is just, you know, follows me around, and she is my shadow, and she has been with me through some rough times. So I think just to have that love, right, is incredible. So, she's a person, so I can't even call her an animal. I don't know what to say.
Hey, and Bob, I didn't know your dog had its own Facebook page. You should tell us what it is.
It was.
Because that's the very beginning.
It was Barnaby Eden, but he died. And I had issues with Facebook where they wouldn't allow me to sign back in for some reason. So but that was really good, because people would post stuff on his page. And I'd answer in dog speak, you know, it'd be either whoop or woof, woof, woof. You know, so it was.
Yeah, you.
Yeah, it was a running joke.
Oh, you're crazy.
But I would like to thank everybody for allowing me this platform to share the tools that I've used. And all like, in the final analysis, because we're all sovereign, unique, and equal, all I have is my own story. And I'm trying to live a good one. And I believe that simply by sharing our own stories, we help to heal each other. And so for my 10-step program, I will just copy that and paste it into the NASCAR group Facebook page. And now my body is in need of sustenance, so I'm going to go off and do something that is meditation for me. I love cooking. I love it.
Oh. Well, you can cook me something anytime. Just send it to Colorado. Come on down.
Well, you come to me and we go sailing around the Whitsunday Islands. You know, it's...
there we go. Well, thank you, Bob. So thank you so much. You too. You have a great evening.
This has been awesome.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. Thanks for keeping it going. Have a good night. Or a good day. Yeah, good day.
Hey, good day, mate. No worries, mate.
Bye, Bob.
Okay. See you, Phil.
That's a good g'day, Kim. I'm impressed.
Yeah, I've been practicing when it comes on. When I remember, you know, because it's starting to get dark here, so I always want
right.
to say goodnight.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that we had some really good conversations around those steps.
Absolutely.
So, I was glad that Bethany shared with us and came on. She's always got some good ideas.
I'm hopeful that there were others that were streaming in that, you know, found that informative.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it is important. I know that the subject just in general of forgiveness is kind of a hot button. I mean, as far as that goes, because everybody's in their own place. And so
that's true.
Yeah, it's hard to tell people. You can't tell people to forgive or to work on these steps because it takes them being in a place where they're ready. And I guess I wasn't even ready to start doing this even deeper work until now, but I always put my kids first and even my grandkids. That's just where my head always goes, is to putting them, you know, I'd rather spend time with them than spend time in the therapy chair, but that's why the horse thing is.
That's why they call it work, right? I mean, it really is work.
Yep.
Worthwhile work.
Yeah.
But it's definitely work.
I think there, to some degree, I probably miss animals too, but I don't necessarily want to take on that responsibility right now. But I always had cats too, growing up, and when my kids were growing up, I always had a cat. Last cat was here when my mom died. I'm sorry, is that Philip? Are you trying to talk?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Penelope? Somebody?
No, I wasn't.
I'm sorry. I thought somebody was trying to say something. No, I was just going to say I got the last cat, and her name was Noelle, and I got her right after my mom died at Christmas time, because my mom died at the 13th of December, and then within 2 weeks, we had planned on getting another cat, because we already had one, and we wanted a friend for her. And I kept going back and forth, you know, because I was dealing with grief and everything. And I found that she was probably the most helpful in my grief
you know, just because they just help absorb some of that.
Oh, yeah, they do. They do, absolutely. Yeah. I can totally, yeah. I understand. I totally understand. But they, yeah, they are, cats are tough because they're not like dogs. I mean, dogs are, I think, just a little bit, if you are leaving them, you know, like on a trip, I think cats are a little harder sometimes.
They hold a grudge.
They hold a grudge.
My neighbor, yeah. My neighbor leaves her cat outside sometimes because the cat goes off and wanders off. So sometimes she just has to leave, so she leaves it outside. It's outside right now.
Oh. You help take care of it when she's gone?
No.
She come visit you? No. Oh.
Visit you? The cat was looking at my window, and sometimes, like, I'll put my hand against her window, and it'll rub its head against my hand.
Aww.
I call that OPC.
Probably wants to see other people's cats.
You call that what?
OPC, other people's cats. And that's perfect, because you get all the benefit, but not the responsibility. Right.
Yeah, I guess so.
I know. That's what I always say about my kids, too. You know, I'm like, they've all got dogs. Nicole has a cat. Brandy has three horses. So, you know, I can just go visit them. But it is sometimes just, I remember what I missed the most was her greeting me when I came home. I think that was what I missed the most, having that greeting. So, and then all my kids left too, you know, so I was really lonely.
That can be
still climbing out of that. Yeah, isn't it? Crazy. Well, do you have anything else you wanted to say, Philip, before we close out?
Nothing but good night, and I hope to talk to you tomorrow.
Well, thank you, Philip. You'll have a great night. Take care. Glad you're on. Penelope? Want to say
great show, Kim.
Close out.
No, just, I mean, just a great show, and I'm, you know, I'm always appreciative when I, we can get these dialogues and share our experiences and sometimes our differences of opinion, and but I think, you know, like the hearing each other's testimonies and ups and downs and processes and healing modalities is just, I think it helps us all. So I do appreciate the show we had tonight and show that you facilitated. You did a great job, and as you always do, I learned a lot. So thank you. You know, I love doing it with you.
Thank you. I love doing it. We've got to talk soon. And thank you, Mr. Bob Eden. We're glad that you were on with us tonight and just gave us some things to talk about. We needed some subjects to talk about. So we can always count on you. We appreciate that. So I guess we'll go ahead and close out the show tonight, and I don't know who's on tomorrow night, but Philip may be joining you tomorrow night, whoever's on.
Oh, I so think it's Dr. Romo. He's very good, Dr. Heidi
Romo.
Very, very good.
Oh, yeah.
So, very interactive, and he's like, always learn something when he's on. Well, I love to see when everybody's on, but I really enjoy his trauma-informed, trained approach. So if that's what you're looking for, I would say definitely tune in tomorrow night.
Oh, okay, good. Well, yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I wasn't paying attention. But, yeah, so thank you again, everybody, for being on. And as we always say on the show, or Ms. Penelope started saying it, is that there are enough eyes and ears out in the world for all children to be safe, you know, to watch out for all children. So we've got to be able to stand up for their rights and for the things that they can't say. So if you see something, please say something. You keep our children safe. Have a good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was